Welcome to Sales Talk for CEOs. I'm glad you're here. I'll be interviewing CEOs who have successfully scaled their B2B sales organization. In each episode, I'll start by uncovering the sales background of each CEO, dig into the strategies they use to build their sales organization, and wrap it up with what the future holds. We'll cover the good, the bad, and the ugly of scaling a sales organization. I'm your host, Alice Hyman.
Welcome to the expert series of Sales Talk for CEOs. I'm very excited today because I'm going to get to talk to someone with all of you that I haven't talked to in a really long time. And that is Sean Burke from Prometric. He is the COO there, but that's not what I have him on the show to talk about, even though he does run sales and all the go-to-market activities there. He has built 9 companies, sold 7 of them, and 2 are still running. So he knows a thing or two about starting up companies and growing sales organizations. And in fact, he's taken all of that and organized it very nicely into 5 key areas that we're going to talk about today, and then take a deep dive into a very important area about performance conditions that get you the best players and allow you to keep them working for you. He's pretty expert at that. So welcome to the show, Sean.
It's great to be here, Alice. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, you have had a long career. I met you. I'm not trying to say you're old, but you know, you're at least as old as I am. So
it's hard to hide the gray. Yeah.
And I met you when you were at KiteDesk. Now that has been a long time, but when we started chatting earlier, we were trying to figure out how long ago was that? What was that? KiteDesk. Oh yeah. So, and KiteDesk and 8 other companies have really given you a wealth of knowledge on what CEOs need to know about sales.
Correct. Yes, I have quite a few stories.
Okay, and I hope you're going to share some today. But I want to talk about the 5 areas that you have really pinpointed. And I also have heard through the grapevine that you are writing these into a book. So more on that later. But sure. Let's talk about these 5 areas. You mentioned to me building the team, crafting the culture is one of my favorites. The one we're going to really dig into today, which is performance conditions where top talent will definitely want to work for you. Leading the team and sustaining.
That's right.
Sustaining it, which is so important these days. So how did you come down to these 5? That's very specific. But all those years and all those companies, how was it that you figured out that these are the things that CEOs, CROs, leadership need to focus on?
Well, a lot of the work that went into me figuring this out was really mistakes that I made and trial and error. I mean, there's no one that I've seen who's like basically said, here's how you build and sustain a successful sales organization, regardless of what challenges that you're faced. I mean, there's great knowledge on sales and leadership, but there's kind of a gap in between the middle. So most all of what's gone into this research and how we broke it out are lessons learned. And I will tell you, this really came together in the last 6 months for me. I had it all in my head, like you probably doing different things, but like there wasn't a way that it was organized. And over the last 6 months, working with some people that I work with every day, it started to like almost a picture came out in my mind. And then once that picture came out, I said, this is something that I've got to start documenting and I've got to start, you know, putting it into a structure and format. So, it's 25 years, but in the last 6 months is where it all started making a lot of sense to me.
Oh my gosh. I love it. I love it. So obviously, you know, CEOs are really concerned with building the right team for sales for their whole organization. But let's face it, if we don't get the sales, you know, we're going to have a rough time with our investors and our stakeholders. So building that team, especially the sales team, and then crafting the right culture. Let's just talk about that for a minute before we dive into the performance conditions. So once you've built the right team, how do you really craft the right culture?
Yeah. So this is something that I've learned over the last 3 years is that, and a lot of people that are in sales, they don't look at a company like they're joining a team, which they should. They look at like, I'm going to sell this product, I'm going to join this company, right, etc. But when they get into the business and they start doing the work, it's really the team that they work with and that environment and they work with that is going to help them be successful or not. And so crafting the culture of a sales organization is different than building mission, vision, values for a company. It's really almost like, how do we build an organization that will naturally attract the best sales people because you've done the hard work to do it. So just some of the minor pieces of it is that in my organizations now, we have our own set of norms. So, you know, most companies have company values, but we have normative behaviors that we think are important for us to run our business by. We have 5 of them. Everybody remembers them. Every quarter we give out awards on it. All of our awards come from the bottoms up. It's not a top-down award system. So that in and of itself is a part of the culture. And then every single piece of our business, all my teams has a charter. What are we here to do? What are our key measures? So like part of the culture is everybody understanding like who's doing what, what's my role, how do I align to this, what matters to us, how are we gonna run this business? And so it's a decision that you have to make versus letting it evolve. And so some of the things that I've been writing about are things that like when you come into a culture or a company, you'll see people talking about our mission, vision, and values. Right. And, you know, that happens a lot. But what you should really be looking at is when there's decisions that are made, who wins and why do they win and what do people do? So, for example, if you have to make a decision on economics in the business versus going after revenue or going after EBITDA, what wins? Do you go after the revenue? And that tells you, more importantly, you know, what the business is really about and what's really important to them. And then, you know, when you're doing deals in sales, like what's more important, capturing the profit or getting the deal done and things like that. So this is all part of like, how do you create the culture? And making sure that you have to, I mean, my organization goes from Japan all the way to San Francisco. So having that consistency and everybody feeling that they're a part of it is something that I will not let be an accident. It's something that has to be collective. And by the way, it's not easy to do when you're dealing with global cultures that have different ways of operating. And so you have to be very sensitive about even how you talk across all these, so everybody feels included and understood. So it sounds like it's easy, but it takes a lot of work.
Wow. Yeah, I can see that. Can you give us the 5? Do you have them off the top of your head? The 5 normatives?
I do. So the first one is celebrating excellence. So we think that it's really important to recognize people that do amazing things. The second one is being transparent in the organization. So, you know, making sure that we, you know, say, you know, share information, et cetera. The third one is being data driven and sharing information, sharing the data across the team. The fourth one is putting our customers first and all the decisions that we're going to make in the organization. And then like the fifth one is something that we do all the time, but it's having your next day be better than the day that you're in. It's like this constant improvement and constant working on the business. And so every quarter we give out awards. We have a culture committee that does it. Nice. Every year annually, we give out an annual award, which is a really big deal. And so, and it's, by the way, it was a grounds up effort. So instead of me coming in and saying, what's the culture of the organization? We did surveys and we did interviews. And so that's how it all came to be.
Wow. I think that people out there listening are thinking, I'd like to work for a company that had normatives, right? And that is a big bold statement about your culture, because you're saying, here are the 5 things, we're all going to live by them. If you feel at some point, you know, you're not going to live by that, you're probably going to self-select out of here. And that's great, because we want to keep the team working together and all working on that same wavelength.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And I think for people, especially, you know, I've seen people change with working from home. Like, it is a very different culture, not being at a whiteboard together and like having a meal together. Like, it's so like you're sharing, like, it's very hard to build a culture when it's screen bound. And so we're doing the best attempt that we can do it. But I think it's really important for people to be able to see what you stand for and see leaders actually do it. Like, for example, when I talk data driven, I mean it. So after every single board meeting I have, the Friday after that board meeting, every single employee, over 2,000 people, are invited to a meeting, and I will share the exact slides I shared with the board, no matter what. And just that move tells them, you know, and that ties to being data driven. That's
part of transparency, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's important. And there's just not enough of that out there right now in corporate America, that's for sure. All right, let's move to number three, which is where we want to spend a little more time and dig in. I think this is so important. And for every one of my clients and every CEO I've ever worked with, they all want to know when I first arrive on the scene, do I have the right salespeople in place? Do I have the right sales leader in place? Are the, you know, is this the right team? Are they A players? And if they are, how do I keep them, right? How do I attract and retain the best? And it's something that most people really don't have any clue how to make that happen. They just don't know. Now, having a strong culture around sales is going to be important for everyone, right? Because we all should be customer focused these days, but especially for anybody in the go-to-market team, they want to see that you have that strong culture. And they, if they can see that you don't, obviously it will be hard to attract. Even if you attract them and then they're there for a while and they see this culture isn't really a sales culture, it isn't really customer focused, they're going to leave, right? They're going to be looking for their next thing. So this is so important, yet I feel very few people know how to do it. And I don't think there's even a lot written on it. I mean, I do read some stuff on attracting and retaining talent, but from a CEO perspective or a leader's perspective, let's talk about that. What are the conditions that allow you to find and retain that top talent?
Sure. So, the first thing that I want everybody to know is, and by the way, I think this is really important. So for all the CEOs that are out there and all the people that are interviewing salespeople, there are certain questions outside of all that I do to find top salespeople. But I know from the questions that they ask me if they're top talent or not. And then once I tell you the questions, then I'll tell you how we build performance conditions to naturally attract those types of people. So, and I studied this. So like when we bring in talent, we first, you have to have data, you have to track it. But what I looked at is, what are the questions salespeople ask me? And then how did they go? So here's the questions that I hear from top performers. First of all, what did your top rep make last year? W-2. The second one is, what percentage of your team made quota last year? Mm-hmm. And third, how quickly will I get up and running and be able to start selling? And then fourth, I mean, if we go to four, is I want to see your comp plan. So those, if you work backwards from that, top performers want to know what's the high end of the mark. And by the way, you know, the first thing that they say to themselves is, I'm going to beat that. I'm going to beat them. Like, and they're like, okay, I'll write that number down. So I'll at least put another $100,000 on that. Then they want to know that this thing isn't sloppy and that, you know, a large percentage of the people are going to make their number or not. Because it's a risk for them to move. Like, no break. Right. If they're hitting their number somewhere, they're not going to move to a place where 90% of the people are not making their number. Right. One crazy person made the number and they blew it all away. It's also a sign that's like, does the person who's leading the sales team know what they're doing? So let's work backward from that. So, and by the way, my estimate, if you look at building a high performing sales team, between 50, maybe 40 on the low end, and 70% of your ability to build a great sales team is who you put on the field, first of all. So performance conditions at max are 30 to 50% or so of what you do as a leader to create an environment where they're successful. But you can't get the best people unless you have the performance conditions. So it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg. Okay.
Right. So, well, what's interesting too is, you know, something that you said might surprise people. It's not what you ask, it's what they ask you that 100%. Lets you know if they're a top player. And I agree. Whenever, you know, maybe during the conversation they ask it, but then also at the end when I give them the opportunity to ask questions, if they don't ask me those type of questions, I am wondering why. Right. So, something to think about.
For sure. I mean, the top performers in the world never need a job. And I look at it like I'm recruiting a top talent to my university and it's a competitive marketplace and I will do whatever it takes to get them. But I also need to be able to identify who they are. So if you jump into the performance conditions, this is a very hard thing to do. And it literally has probably taken me 23 years to figure this out. And by the way, Alice, there's no way we're going to be able to get into all of it on this podcast, but I'll try to share some key pieces of it. And then you can decide like how we break it down. So the first thing is you have to have a compensation plan that they can understand easily and they know how to make money on it. So every compensation plan that I have includes a comp calculator. And so we can do the math together to say, let's look at your pipeline. Let's add these things in. I want them to know what they need to do to be able to make their money. By the way, most, even the best salespeople in the world, I've had to train them on the math around making the money they want. So I call this thing the W-2 conversation. What do you want to make at the end of the year? What's your base salary? And then everything that's in between that, let's show you the math that you have to go through to make that money. And I love having that conversation. I also love it when salespeople break a comp plan and next thing you know, the head of finance is going, oh my God, this number is way too big. It's way too big. And I have to like shepherd that comp plan and that deal all the way up through the board because they're freaking out about how much it is. And by the way, every person that's broken seven figures for me, that check went to the board and it had to be explained. So you've got to have a leader that can kind of do that. So let's work back from this. Well, and by the way, do you want to go more into the comp plan or like we can go into some other areas?
Yeah, I'd like to hear a little bit more about the comp plan.
Sure. So the way that we want our comp plan to work is if you just hit your numbers, it should be your OTE, but it's a graduated scale. So if you, and by the way, the data that you need to have to help inform the comp plan needs to be solid. So let's just say, for example, you have a sales team that 70% of their team makes their quota or they reach, let's just say 100% of your team makes 70% of their quota. Then really the comp plan needs to start at 70% because everything below that is you paying for their salary. And then really you start to see the performance above that. And then the outliers are the people that go so far up, they, what I call break the comp plan. And that's where the 2X, the 3X, the 4X come in because all the best talent in the world come into every organization thinking that they're going to break their comp plan. And by the way, what I found in sales organizations, some of the top performers in certain areas will do more than an entire region in new business, and they're worth it. So the comp plan for us has to be really easy to understand. I want to be able to talk them through scenarios because in every comp plan, one of the things they said, well, there's a management discretion piece of it, which there freaks every top performer out. It's like, wait, so if I go sell this thing, you're going to cut my commission in half and it's going to be a thing. So I talked them through all of that. But it really, we kind of talk about it. It should feed the eagles and kind of starve the turkeys. It's like, it's a meritocracy. It's like, you know, if you do really well here and we all give you the same opportunity to do it, there's nothing capping you from being able to do this. And the more we can work together to help you show it, the more important it is. And so the other thing that I like to show new hires is here's our performance against our plan, our leaderboard. Here's how many people met quota, what their quota were, et cetera. So that's just the comp plan. So that's step one. So the next step that I would say, which is the hardest, is there's a tremendous amount of math that goes into effectively running a sales organization that I've seen very few, really, if any, sales or CEO leaders figure out. So I'm not going to go through the complexities of it, but what I will go through is the easy parts that most teams should be able to figure out. So for example, setting quotas for me is a mathematical exercise. So last year, we worked so hard on making sure that we knew what we thought our numbers would be, right? And I can't share you what those numbers are, but we were less than a tenth of a percent off of a year-end number in planning at the beginning of the year, which is extreme. Like, there's a lot of math that goes into it. But here's the reason why that matters to attracting great salespeople is, if you can't share with them the math and how people get to their numbers, then why would they ever join your team? And so if I can say mathematically, with all of the conversion numbers that we have with our TAM, with our green space, with our white space, with the products we have, and like laying all out all this math, then as a leader, I should be able to call my shot within, you know, some level of percentage, and then all my quotas and comp come based off of that. And if you do it year over year, then sales reps would be like, look, I trust this person. My numbers make sense to me, and I have a path to hit it. So those two things, I think, are kind of like a yin and yang is, well, okay, great. You have a great comp plan, but everybody has these crazy quotas. No one's going to make them. So who really cares about the comp plan? So let me stop there and see if you want to dig into those, any of those areas anymore.
Yeah, I think that both of those are very important, and most companies don't have it figured out. Their comp plans reward the wrong behavior. They do crazy things like you only get comped on the first year of a multi-year contract. So like, why would your salespeople do multi-year contracts? Even though you keep telling them to do multi-year contracts, but why would I? You don't pay me to do that. I get more when I have to renew it the next year and do the upsell and I get paid again, you know? So I find that a lot of companies reward the wrong behaviors, and that creates a problem. And it's not easy for salespeople to figure out what they're going to make, and it should be. And on the quota, you know, I think most companies come up with it out of thin air. It's just like, oh, here's a number. Let's take that. They don't really do the math. The math is super important. And we should be able to work backwards. So here's your number. Here's how many deals you have to close at this dollar amount with this percent of margin or whatever your company, you know, what all the things are to make your number so that everybody's really clear on it. And I just don't see it. I just don't see it happening. Most of the companies I work with, the salespeople couldn't tell you how many deals they need to close. So I think those two things are super important. Now, if you're trying to, again, attract and retain top talent, you've got to figure these things out, because as soon as they figure out that you don't have it figured out, they're going to go on to someplace else.
So let me take it a step further. Every single salesperson on my team has those numbers in a customized dashboard to them. So there's a concept out there, I'm sure you've heard of it, called the sales velocity formula. The sales velocity formula basically gives you directionally a way to say, am I going to hit my number or not? And I look at it globally across my entire sales organization, and I look at it by each individual sales team. And then our sales leaders look at it by each and every salesperson. So we may have someone in North America that has an average deal size of $300,000. They have a close ratio of 46%, and they have, you know, X number of deals in the pipeline, and then they have this time to close. Where somebody else has a lot less deals, the deal sizes are higher, the time to close is longer, but they close, you know, way more of them. So what we're trying to do is use these numbers as well to inform us on, like, what can we learn from this rep who may have less deals, but they never miss their number because they're only working great deals. And so everybody working off of the same template, then we can have a common nomenclature, and we can go through the math and just say, Joe, here's what your close ratio is. Bill's close ratio is 10% higher. What are you guys doing differently? By the way, why is Jane's time to close 60 days shorter than yours? And why is our time to close for existing business longer than new business? It should be shorter. And then add on to that, a third thing that we're doing this year is we're not just using our math on it. We've now invested in AI forecasting to be able to have another view. So not only do our sales leaders come in and they say they make their call for the quarter, but we also have data behind it that says, here's what we've seen on all the data of all the deals that you worked and what the data tells us. Now, by the way, the data is never 100% right. And the sales leaders are never 100% right. But by comparing the two, then we start to learn, what does the data know that our sales leaders don't know? And what do our sales leaders know that the data doesn't know? And we can combine those two together to get a much more accurate forecast, which then you can show to all of the sales reps. Like, if I was a sales rep looking for a job, is to say, show me your forecast. What's your performance against the forecast? Like, show me that you know how to run this business so I'm not taking a risk to come into it. And by the way, we could totally geek out on this for a while, but
we could totally. Probably should have a whole nother show on it. But so you've kind of given two key things that are very metric, very analytical. But in terms of performance conditions, what's kind of on the softer side of that, that would help you retain this top talent?
Yeah, so this is all personal. So by the way, and I offer it to every single person on my team, very few people will actually do it. So it's a little bit of a career disappointment in me, is that I haven't found a way to do it. But I make the barrier very hard, is I will coach anybody on my sales team, but very few people will do the things that I ask them in coaching to keep it up. So so let me give you the first thing that I do.
Yeah.
Is and a lot of people think it's going to be jumping into sales coaching. It is not. It is not. What I ask people that work for me is, what do you want your life to be about? What are you here to do? Like we only have a short amount of time. What do you want to accomplish? And if you don't know, come back to me when you figure it out, because I can't help you achieve your life meaning if you don't know what that's going to be. And many people don't do it. Let's drop down an easier level. Then within the construct of our business is, how can we help you achieve your life mission within that? And so there's a process that I use with them to help them uncover themselves and their branding. So here's, I call it, it's not a great term, but I think the process is really important. So with my top performers, what I have them do is to say, what is it that you do? And be very specific. Am I an enterprise rep? Am I, you know, an SDR, whatever? But the more specific they can describe to me what it is that they do, then we document that. Then the other side is, what do you do in that pursuit unique to everybody in the world? And they're like, I don't. And I'm like, now let's start the process. What is going to be your fingerprint on that? That will, no matter, by the way, if they do this, they will never look for work their life, ever in their life.
Yes.
So we start the process on that. And then the next two steps on it are, what are the numbers that you have to prove that you can do that? Because everyone's going to say, well, prove it to me. And then the third piece of it is, who do you have as references that will tell your story for you? And I can guarantee you this, anybody who takes the effort to do this will never have to worry about money the rest of their life, will never have to worry about a career the rest of their life, but so people do it. And so that's like where I try to start. And then in every deal, I do deal strategy work, and I will sell, my CEO will sell, we sell, everybody sells in our organization, so they know that they have an absolute support mechanism. And by the way, I will play any role. I will be a note taker in sales. I don't care. I don't have to be the lead of it. You tell me how to best help you in that role, and I'll do it. So I think that mixture of having the right performance conditions, genuinely caring about the people that work for you and what they want to do with their lives, and then walking the walk and taking that effort, knowing that it's going to be hard, and putting hurdles in it to say, you know, we'll do this, but you've got to meet me halfway on it. I think those three things have really helped me continue to attract people. And allow people to follow me from company to company that have seen that they've been successful in every single one of the companies that we've done together.
Like the beloved Sarah.
Love Sarah for sure. Absolutely.
So yes, because I know you two have been together for a long time, and she loves that culture that you provide. I think what you said about offering the coaching is very important. And even though you have sales leaders who should be coaching their sales people, you're offering something more than that. And the simple fact that you offer it provides a culture and shows that you care. The fact that hardly anyone takes you up on it is sort of sad. And I agree that it is hard, but I'm 100% with you on that. And I do, it's so funny, you and I have so many things so similar. I do a very similar thing. If people ask me to mentor them and, you know, they're not in a position to pay me for what I do, I do the same thing. I'm like, first, I need to understand what your life is about, what you want, what are your hopes and dreams, you know, what is the vision for your life, and how does what you're asking me to help you with fit into that? Because oftentimes they'll just go down the wrong path with their work if they don't understand what their life is about, or, you know, why they've been put on this planet and what they want out of the short time that they'll be here, right? So I think those are important things to help people figure out. But you're right, a lot of people don't want to do that hard work.
They don't. And a lot of people raise their hand, but few people actually go through it, because there's a level of self-inspection that a lot of people...
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's like hard, and it's uncomfortable.
It is. I literally, last week, I put this post on LinkedIn, and this guy who interviewed for me, he actually worked for me. He works for another company right now. I was talking about this process. And he's like, Sean, I remember when we went through this when I was interviewing, because like you thought my answer wasn't really good. And I was like, no, your answer was horrible. It was not good. He went to his wife. He went to his family. Like, they had a family conversation. Like, what am I really good at? Like, what am I? And so,
yes.
But it matters. Like, then all of a sudden you go through this exploration. It's like, what am I really good at? And like, and you see this is probably as much as I do, is like when people that are gifted in sales reach a certain point in their career, and almost every single one of them have done it with me, the first question they ask me is, well, is it time for me to go to sales leadership? And I'm like, I don't know. You tell me. And most of them never want to be a sales leader.
Never.
Ever.
Exactly. They never want to be a sales leader. Right.
That's right. They don't.
I'm with you. I also think that the second thing you said about you and your CEO and your senior leadership team will sell, right? I think that today, and you know, I talked about this a little bit earlier on, the days of the lone wolf seller, the individual contributor, or like I call them, the hero seller, you know, swoop in and, you know, meet the customer and close the deal. Those days are gone. And sellers are just too sophisticated. If they're going to buy from you, they want to know you as a company. They want to know your senior leadership. They want to know your subject matter experts. They want to see that you have a team that's going to support them. And if they're a larger company than you, especially, right, when we have some of these companies that are, you know, sub 100 million, or even just, you know, sub a billion, right, and they're selling to companies that are 10 to 1,000 times their size, the people they're selling to deserve to know their leadership team and the people that are going to support once the sale is done. And so we have to really understand that we all have a role in sales. The CEO will always have a role in sales. It's just that that role changes as the company matures. And all the senior leaders need to be willing to dig in and sell and do their part, not do the salesperson's job for them, but the salesperson alone just simply cannot close those multi-year, multi-million dollar, big type of deals, or whatever a big deal is for your particular company. They can't close those complex deals on their own. They need an entire team. And when an A player comes in and sees that the CEO, the CRO, the COO, the senior people are willing to get in there and sell with them, that makes them want to work for you.
It does. And, you know, our business is almost all of our deals are above $1 million. And we have deals that are, you know, up to $60 million. So you should not sell a heroic sale with that amount because of the impact that you have to that buyer's business. It is a disservice to them, and it's risky. So for us, you know, many of our clients, we could represent up to 70% of their revenue. So we want the CEO and their CEO to build a relationship. Like, it's very common that we have quarterly reviews with just our CEO and their CEO so they could talk about business. Our CFO goes, you know, we'll talk financials, how we're doing financing, how we structure contracts, how these deals work. Like, and I also think that it gives them more comfort that they're working with a business. I mean, by the way, I just did this yesterday. We literally laid out our clients. We signed a new client. We literally laid out from the CEO down to the individual customer success representative who goes where and the alignment and what that motion of our relationship is going to be and define how we're going to do it and define how it works. So, the way, I love that because now the entire company is engaged and the likelihood of success is much higher. So,
absolutely. I could not agree more. So just before we wrap up here, let's go through the last two, leading the team and sustaining it. So just talk briefly about leading the team.
Yeah. So there's a few things that sales leaders have to do that I find is the first thing is they have to be credible for a sales team. So I've always prided myself that I can sell. You cannot, in my experience, if I can't do role plays with the team, like everything I ask them to do, I will do. So like, for example, when we do role plays, I am the first one to raise my hand. I'll say, look, I'm a little rusty. I don't even know this product maybe yet, but I'm going. I am going to be in your shoes walking. So as a leader, you're almost, in some ways, I feel like I'm not leading from the front. I'm leading from within. Like we are a team of people. And I want you to know that I am engaged with you as a team. And I want them to know how I fight for them internally. I want them to know, like, I want them to know everything about how we're leading this organization. So they have comfort, like that they know that there's somebody who's almost like representing them to the organization in a way that they trust them. And I want them to have visibility, and I want them to know, because the more they know, the better they'll do. And they can even share it with their clients. So a lot of what I talk about in leading the team is, you know, I call it the pulpit. Sometimes you have to evangelize, and sometimes you have to get up there and you have to, you know, tell them what the focus areas are. So a lot of the leadership of the team is how you act towards them on an individual level. Like, for example, like one section is leading a team is different than leading an individual. And so the way you act around your team is very different than when you're one-on-one, and you shouldn't play, those roles are different. So how you lead the team needs to be very direction oriented, things like that. Wow. How you lead an individual needs to be about them. And so it's just like the nuances of this, what I've learned from totally making every mistake in leadership you can imagine, and how I found that it worked for me. So that's what I talk about there. Yeah.
I think so many CEOs, especially when they're 10 or 20 years in, they just really want to abandon sales. They want that. I've hired a CRO. We have a sales team. I want them to do it. And they don't want to really be involved in sales. It makes them nervous. It scares them. They don't really know what sales is, because I think that sales is some kind of trickery, manipulation, coercion. I don't know what, but it's like they don't want to be involved. It's like, no, I do not want to be involved in sales, right? And that's just the worst possible mindset to have, because sales is, you know, it's just solving, as we know. It's like, if we can solve for what your need is, we can understand it first, if we can guide and we can share insights and we can solve and make your life better because of it, of course you're going to buy from us, right? And we need the CEO's thought leadership and kindness, caring, understanding towards the customer to show up and be really evident for, and all the senior leaders who could possibly be involved. So I love that you have that, you know, kind of serve from within, lead from within. That's really, I think, exactly right for today. All right. So number five, sustaining it.
The reason why I think sustaining success for a CEO and a leader is so important is when I talk about running my business, I have no doubts. I am like, when I say this is our budget for the year, I look at them right in the eyes. I'm like, this is what we're going to do. And how long do you have for me to explain to you how we're going to get there? Because I guarantee you, you're going to get tired before I do. But that level of diligence is how you sustain success. And so that's just one example of doing it. But I think you could probably think through the five or six things. When one headcount leaves or moves around, how do you adjust that? If one product doesn't sell the way that you thought it would, right, how do you make adjustments with other? How do you change the offering? So it's like, how do you keep all the balls up in the air while still riding a bike and going to a direction and getting all those things done? Is and the more time you have at it, the easier it becomes year after year, because your data is better in the way that you do it. So so that's what I cover in those, is how do you do it year after year, and how do you make the adjustments in quarter, in year, to learn from each of those things, is really what I cover in like sustaining the success.
Excellent. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. I could talk to you for hours. We could dive into a lot of this stuff. I'll have to have you back on the show for sure, because there's a lot more to talk about. And I know the book is in progress, but I'm very excited for when it comes out. And if you want someone to read along the way, just give me a holler and I'd be happy to do it, because I'm sure, you know, I can give you some interesting ideas and insight, but I really cannot wait to read this book. And I thank you for sharing all of this wealth of knowledge you have amassed over your many gray hairs of starting companies and selling them.
Well, to be honest, I had this gray hair in my 30s, so it's not the well, I appreciate being on the podcast. Thank you so much. And I'm happy to come back, and we can dive into different topics then. And so that'll be fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Sales Talk for CEOs. You can find me at alicehyman.com. Be sure and connect with me on LinkedIn and let me know that you heard the show. If you found value in today's episode, please subscribe, write a review, and share the show with another CEO.